In the studio this morning, I have Clive Mons, who is a spokesman for eco.org.nz, who has been active in the environmental movement for over 30 years plus, and represents ECO on various fisheries management issues in New Zealand. So, kia ora, Clive, and welcome to the show.
Kia ora.
Clive, New Zealand's fisheries. Really, what is the situation in regard to New Zealand's fisheries and how sustainable are they?
Well, New Zealand fisheries in some ways has a better management system than some parts of the world, but our fisheries are under quite a lot of stress, and I wouldn't describe most of them as sustainable in the current system. Stock levels on a lot of stocks are below what is considered the international benchmark for sustainability. There's a lot of pressure from the fishing industry to fish stocks a lot harder than most of us, and not just the environment sector, but also the recreational fishing sector as well, feel as acceptable levels. So we are working sort of on the edge, if you like, trying to get the maximum productivity out of the fish stock for the profit of the fishing companies. By doing that, we're actually taking fish stocks down below a level that is actually sustainable for the ecosystem of which they are part. And a lot of that comes about by the fact that through the quota management system, which is a property rights-based management system, it's all focused on quota for individual fish stocks. So management is by individual fish stocks, but fish don't exist by themselves. They are part of an ecosystem, and there's food chains and associated activities which interact. So what you do to one fish stock can have an effect on other parts of the environment. And if all you're doing is interested in counting the number of snapper, say, and you don't pay attention to anything else, and fishery science is almost totally focused on stock assessment work, which is actually quantifying how many fish are there. And if that's all you're looking at, and you're not looking at the system that those fish are part of, the ecosystem, and all the things that can affect that ecosystem and then ultimately the fish, you've got this sort of tunnel vision. So you're looking, and you put a lot of effort into counting the fish, but it's like you're looking down a long pipe and you see what's right at the end of the pipe. What everything else around it is largely ignored. And that to us is the fundamental weakness of how we manage fisheries in New Zealand at the moment.
So when you bring a net through and take the snapper, you'd be taking terakee, you'd be taking other fish as well, but you don't count those other fish, you only count the snapper. Is that right?
Fishermen target fish fairly well now. They've got the technology to do that, and certainly in terms of snapper they do that. But you have a range of fish which will be taken as bycatch, and there are systems to take account of that bycatch, but there still is a huge amount of wastage. It's not as bad as it used to be, but in somewhere like orange roughy fisheries and that, you just have huge amounts of wastage because the nets go through, they just take everything in their course. And of course the technology in relation to, say, orange roughy and that, where you're bottom trawling, you're actually also destroying the habitat that's essential for the orange roughy, particularly the young fish, the nursery stock. They need the three-dimensional structure for shelter. And if you destroy that three-dimensional structure by destroying everything that grows on the seabed, you're exposing those fish to predation, and so you're disrupting life cycles. So potentially you're going to reduce the productivity of that stock. That is an issue for things like snapper as well. We've destroyed a lot of the seabed in many ways, not just by fishing methods, but also because of the amount of sedimentation that comes in. Mark Morrison from NIWA, National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, has done some interesting research which has really demonstrated the importance of three-dimensional structure for the really baby snapper just after they've emerged from the larval stage. They're very small, they're very vulnerable to predation. They need places to shelter, and one of the key habitats they use for that is seagrass, and the other one is horse mussel beds. Horse mussels are elongated shell that stick up above the seabed by quite a bit, so they actually provide quite good shelter amongst them.
So they can hide?
Yeah, they can hide from just from being predated. The seagrass beds in New Zealand are a tiny fraction of what they used to be. mainly because of the sedimentation in our harbours and in the close offshore. A lot of horse mussel beds, because horse mussels stick up above the bottom, unlike scallops and a lot of other shellfish, they're very vulnerable to anything that gets dragged across the seabed, so fishing nets or scallop dredges destroys them. And we've only belatedly found out that those sorts of habitats are absolutely critical at certain stages in the life cycle of different species, and the key one we're looking at, of course, in relation to that is snapper.
Yes, there's a situation where you've got New Zealand fishery groups as well as overseas. What percentage of New Zealanders are trawling for all these fishing stocks, and what sort of percentage of overseas interests are involved?
Well, nobody can fish in New Zealand waters unless they're a New Zealand company. Because the fishing industry, particularly when our 200-mile exclusive economic zone came into being in the 70s, New Zealand fishing industry didn't have the capacity to fish that zone. And under international law, if you're not actually fishing your fish, other nations have a right to come in and fish that stock. So what a lot of New Zealand companies do is that they employ foreign charter boats to fish, but they're actually fishing under New Zealand law. They're fishing New Zealand quota, but they have to be basically sort of licensed and organised through a New Zealand fishing company. So you don't actually get foreign vessels coming into New Zealand waters and fishing our fish unless it's done through our fisheries management system.
And we've got observers on every boat so that they comply?
We have certainly not got observers on every boat. In some fisheries, particularly on the high seas fisheries, say for orange roughy, which is outside our exclusive economic zone, there are new agreements which will see observers on every boat. But that's a very small amount of New Zealand's fishing effort. And in a lot of the New Zealand fisheries, particularly the inshore fisheries, there's not a high level of observer coverage. In things like the squid fishery around the southern islands, where there's major problems with sea lion deaths and that, there is a higher percentage of observer coverage, but it's nowhere near 100%. And so what has to be done is that you extrapolate from, say, 10% of the fleet, which does have observer coverage, and you work out from that the total impacts. And we've always argued for a higher level of observer coverage, but particularly in the inshore fisheries, where you're getting your snapper, your trevally, your terakee, and those species, there's very, very low observer coverage.
New Zealand's got one of the largest fishing areas on Earth, hasn't it? A huge area. And so it's very difficult for us to have observers, and I presume that's something we've got to have a look at.
Well, it's an area that is getting beached up, and it's always been a point of conflict between, say, the environment sector and the Ministry of Fisheries as to the level of observer coverage. But of course, every time you put observers on boats, it's quite expensive. The fishing company's got to fund those observers, so therefore there's a lot of pressure from the fishing industry to keep the number of observers down, and also you've got to have big enough boats to actually accommodate them, etc. So that's been a perpetual area of conflict over many years as to just how much surveillance there is. And of course these days there's now the potential to have remote surveillance with remote camera and video. The technology there is actually improving dramatically, and in theory it should be possible to put in systems on the boats which are totally independent of the fishing company, which would allow the ministry to actually monitor what is happening on those boats. That certainly hasn't progressed at the present time.
That's a good idea, because you'd have the cameras positioned where the nets come up out of the water, and you'd see what sort of fish there are and the range of fish. And, of course, you'd see what they did with the fish that they didn't particularly want. And I've heard so many stories of different other species just thrown over the side because it wasn't within their quota. Is this the story?
Well, this is the thing. When quota management system you can only catch, you can only bring in fish you have quota for. And in the early days of the quota system, people had to have quota for the different species, but quite often that wasn't available. And so if people caught fish which were outside of their basket, they would get dumped. It's becoming more current that people cannot go fishing for a certain species unless they have quota for the recognised bycatch species that are associated with that fishery. So they actually have to have some means of covering that. And of course it doesn't work perfectly all the time, but it has been recognised as an issue and there are evolving methods to control some of that. But you'll always still get cases where people end up catching a whole bunch of fish which they weren't targeting and they just happen to catch them, or they haven't got enough quota to cover them. And they want to catch their target species, might be a whole lot more valuable, so they don't want to keep those fish on board occupying freezer space. So yeah, they go over the side, and that's been a long-standing tradition in the fishing industry.
Because I've seen bulging nets come up if there's shark, if there's, I don't know, stingrays or some other species. Don't they all get damaged irreparably in many cases? That you then you throw them over the side and they just float down, another fish eat them and they die? Is that half the story?
By the time a net comes up, particularly if the net's really full, there is crushing and there is a lot of damage. There's certainly a percentage of fish which is caught and which can be returned and will survive. But the basic premise you have to accept is a lot of fish that come up in fish nets aren't going to survive because of the conditions in the net when they're brought up, and also the time taken to actually sort the fish and discard them.
Clive, I know there's always been an ongoing difference between the commercial fishermen and the environmentalists. This is quite an emotional ground for a lot of people. The commercial fishermen, I find that they don't talk about nurseries, they don't talk about young stock so much. It's sort of like a throwaway line. What they're out for is profit. Am I being too tough on them?
You're probably being a little tough on them. I think in part there's been a lack of understanding of these issues, and also usually there's a geographical separation between nursery grounds and where the adult fish are caught. So it's never been considered a major issue. Probably more of an issue is whether you actually target fish when they're spawning. And this happens with snapper, it happens with orange ruffy, and get a whole range of species, because in order to spawn, fish tend to aggregate, come together. So if you're a fisherman, it becomes really attractive to target the fish at that time. But it also means that while you will catch fish which might have already spawned, you're also going to catch a lot of fish which haven't spawned at that particular point in time. So there's been a long argument, both through Maori customary protocols and behaviour and amongst a lot of sectors who have an interest in fisheries, not just environmentalists but also recreationalists, and that have concerns about when you should be fishing. But there's been no rules brought in which stop fishermen targeting spawning stocks, because the overriding factor has always been the economics of the fishery. And that, you know, for some fisheries, hitting spawning stocks is the only economic way to catch them. So that's been the overriding argument. And you can always employ people to argue that there's no benefit to the fish stock by not targeting them at that time and fishing at other times. If you want an opinion to suit your arguments, you can always find somebody, they're paid, who will come up with the arguments that suit your outcomes.
But is that unsustainable?
Potentially unsustainable. It depends entirely on the state of the fish stock and how much they are. I mean, a classic example is the cod fishery in Canada. I'm not talking in terms of the spawning, but it was always thought there was an unlimited supply of cod. What fishermen and managers didn't appreciate that as the stock was fished down, because cod aggregate in schools, it's a behaviour thing, a lot of fish, that where they spend time together, and you've got, you know, these fancy radars and sonars, and that can show you exactly where the fish are. So they could always find schools of fish, and they would fish them and take them out. What they didn't realise, that increasingly they were finding the last schools. So it wasn't until virtually all those schools had been taken that they suddenly realised there was no more fish. Because if you put a net over and you could bring up 5-10 tonnes of fish, he thought the fishery was stable, but they might have been the only fish within 20 miles. But the technology enabled them to find them, whereas old-style fishers would never have known that, and they would have recognised a lot earlier that there was a lot less fish. And the sad thing with the cod fishery, because they drove it down to such small numbers, even though there are cod surviving, they're not rebuilding, because if you reduce your numbers to a large extent, A, it means species fill in the gaps, and some of those species might eat larval cod, or in other ways make it impossible for the stock to rebuild, because they've filled the niches that the cod needed in terms of food and supplies and everything else. There was huge explosions of crabs and horseshoe clams and other things in relation to Canada. And it's a really salutary lesson of what you can do if you take a fish stock down to the point where it's no longer a significant player in the ecosystem, and the ecosystem changes to reflect that. Other species move into that niche that that species had, and then they stop that other species possibly rebuilding, either because of predation or some other factor, food supply. They're taking the food supply that the cod would have needed to rebuild. And so even though the Canadian fish cod stocks collapsed at the beginning of the 90s, they have not rebuilt, which is what everybody assumed. If you stop fishing, the stock would come back. But they were taken past what you might call the point of no return. And that's a potential hazard with fish stocks in New Zealand as well, that you might fish them down to a point where even though there's fish there and they're still breeding. And the argument's always been that because fish produce heaps of eggs, so therefore you get millions of the larval fish, only a tiny, tiny fraction of 1% usually of those fish, say for the snapper, actually recruit into the fisheries, that is, grow big enough to be allowed to be caught. The vast majority end up being food for other species. They die for a whole lot of other reasons. So it's a numbers game. What you're looking at in terms of what becomes your fishery is just a tiny fraction of the original amount of eggs. And so it's always been assumed that you could fish stocks down to a low number, because even that small number would produce enough eggs that it could still rebuild the fishery. But I think there is examples around now that suggest that's not necessarily the case.
Boy, it's a hard lesson to learn, isn't it? You would have thought that they would have just realised this, there's a limit to growth.
Well, I mean, some lessons were learnt from the Canadian crash, which cost hundreds of thousands of jobs, but not as many as you would have thought.
Are there tuna in New Zealand waters that are fished? Because we hear that tuna in the Pacific, or globally, has been really fished heavily. We can tell by the prices that they get up in the Japanese markets. What is the story with tuna?
There are New Zealand fisheries for things like skipjack tuna, but with all the tuna fisheries, as far as New Zealand are concerned, tuna are mainly a tropical species, and New Zealand is sort of right on the edge, the range of most tuna species. So both the quantity and also the size of the fish that come into New Zealand waters are quite different from what they would be further north. And because of variability in isothermals, the temperature levels in the ocean and that, which can move around a lot from season to season, some years New Zealand has quite a good catch rate, other years it's very patchy and it will occur in different places. And one of the arguments about global warming, that can have huge potential on the habitat ranges of fish and where they move. And tuna is one of the ones that's predicted their range will extend, so they will possibly become more fishable from New Zealand. But that's talking about things like skipjack tuna, bluefin tuna, which is a really highly valuable species. That stock is down to probably less than 5% of its original biomass, and it's hovering right on the point of extinction. And it might well happen in the next few years that it just becomes virtually uncatchable. But when it is caught, it is such a high-value species. The Japanese particularly pay such huge amounts for it. There is huge incentive for the fishers to keep fishing it, even though the stock levels are really low, and so there will be lots of argument put up as in the international conventions and everything as to why it's still sustainable to catch tuna. But the reality is that the numbers are scarily low for bluefin tuna, and at some stage the fact that you can get $5,000-$10,000 for a fish is not going to matter a damn, because if the fish aren't there, you're not going to get your money anyway. So yeah, that's reality of the tuna fishery. It's had a huge number of people chasing it for years, and in New Zealand the tuna fishery has varied from having a couple of hundred boats, a lot of which would only fish for a few weeks a year, down to a tiny fraction of that number of people actually fishing for tuna now, because the market changes, availability changes, and it's not economic to be fishing when the fish might be only available for a few weeks of the year.
I'm speaking with Clive Mons on fishing stocks and what's happening within the realms of fisheries in New Zealand. Clive, I have noticed or heard that mahi-mahi, which you find in Hawaiian waters, are actually being found in the Hauraki Gulf here in Auckland, and also walu, which are in Fijian waters, is found in the northern waters of New Zealand. So does this mean that the ocean is warming from the equator out towards the Tropic of Capricorn, Tropic of Cancer, and so fish within this realm are able to travel over a far greater area?
That's potentially happening. We have always had on the northeast coast of New Zealand, the North Auckland Current comes down the northern coast and it brings warmer tropical water down to New Zealand. And this is why the Poor Knights Islands, which sort of is out there off the coast in that current, often has species and gets larva fish which arrive and develop there that you don't get anywhere else in New Zealand. And it varies very much from year to year depending on weather patterns and everything else. There is potential with the oceans warming, as global warming indicates, that we are going to see a lot more of that sort of thing, simply because the range of those fishes is extending. And at the moment, nothing's really been done in New Zealand to actually work out what effect that might have on New Zealand fisheries. It will mean we'll get more visitors from northern climates, but that's probably not going to be too frequent, and they might come and go because conditions might change on a short-term basis. What is potentially more likely is that at some stage in the future, the warming of New Zealand's seas is going to have some effect on some of our recognised fish stocks. We can't at this stage predict, because nobody has actually done any work in this regard, and when I've raised it in fisheries meetings and that, people sort of look at you as though it's a little strange. But what was a trickle is now becoming quite a flood of international literature on impacts of global warming on fisheries. And it's not just that the fish themselves might move, but what they feed on and that might move, so that they find themselves moving. And quite a good example is the North Sea off the east coast of England, which for some reason has probably warmed up more than relatively than most bodies of water. And there was a fishery for little sand eels, which are, they're actually a small fish, they call sand eels over there, and they are tent fisher sensitive, and they have moved north because of the warming water. They've actually moved north 120-200 kilometres, and that would not have been noticed by people at all, apart from the fact that they are a key food source for British seabirds when they're feeding the young in nesting season. And they've had a couple of really catastrophic breeding seasons for British seabirds, because the birds haven't been able to find fish for the young, so the young have died. If they've found them, they've actually had to fly a lot longer, a lot further, so their energy input and uptake is a huge lot more. And when it's affected things like the puffin, you know, which is a iconoclastic British seabird, that suddenly sent warning signals and people started wondering what the hell is going on. And what it was that a key prey species had moved north to stay within its temperature range, and that's a direct effect of global warming. Now, that sort of thing can happen in New Zealand. We don't know what those effects are going to be. But take, for instance, snapper. Snapper recruitment, its ability to get a large number of fish big enough to become commercially fishable. Whether you have a good breeding year or bad breeding year has been Malcolm Francis, who was at the University of Auckland, now with NIWA, discovered years ago there's a temperature relationship, and depending on seawater temperature in February, you can predict how successful that particular year is going to be in terms of snapper recruitment. Now, there are some potential issues at the extremes, either cold or hot, of just how well that temperature relationship works, but in most years it's a pretty good indicator of how many young snapper are going to grow into the fishery. What happens if we do have a significant increase in water temperature and the water gets warm to the point where the reliability of that index becomes unstable? We might have years when we thought we were going to get a lot of snapper and we don't. And that can be due to a whole range of factors, probably not directly related to the snapper, but to the plankton that the baby larval fish find on just after they hatch. They are dependent on a relatively small range of plankton of the right side for food. Now, if those plankton are not there because of some effect of water temperature change, those tiny larval fish can die, so they never get a chance to recruit. Some other species further up the food chain, some predator species might become more abundant and therefore eat more of the baby fish, so again they don't grow big enough. I mean, snapper is lucky in that particularly once it gets older, it's an omnivore, it eats just about anything, but some other fish species are more dependent on a particular food supply, and that food supply might move, just like the sand eels moved in the North Sea, and that might mean that fish stock can move to coincide with its food supply, but it might mean that it's no longer able to be caught where people have traditionally caught it. So we can have a whole range of different things happen simply by changes in temperature, and not just on the relatively small number of fish that New Zealanders catch, whether they're recreational fishes or commercial fishes. Because of all the components of their ecosystem, whether it's algae or plankton or baby feed fish for those species, either change their habitat or they don't survive because their breeding has been disrupted by changes in temperature, they might move somewhere else so that they're not there at the point in the life cycle what we recognise as a fish we like to eat needs them. And so we're entering a whole period of unpredictability, and that was sort of highlighted with that issue about dogs dying on North Shore beaches.
North Shore of New Zealand.
That's right. When the toxin that killed them originates with Japanese pufferfish, which are not seen in New Zealand waters. Nobody knows the exact pathway for that, because it seems the dogs seem to have been eating sea slugs, which somehow have picked up this poison. So nobody knows the exact pathway, but that's the sort of unpredictable thing that could start happening in a whole range of ways. Yeah, because it's like, you know, when you're cooking something on the stove, if you raise the temperature, different things happen. And we don't know. But what we do know is that globally, sea temperatures are rising. There's other effects from global warming, including acidification, because the seas are absorbing more CO2, so therefore the water, you're getting carbonic acid in increased quantities. That has huge implications for shellfish and also plankton, because a lot of plankton have a carboniferous shell, and if they can't make their shells, they are possibly going to die out or be in much smaller quantities. So our whole shellfish industries and a whole lot of other things could ultimately be affected by those sorts of effects. And at the moment, we just don't even begin to know enough to know what those effects are, and we'll just have to wait and see at this stage.
We haven't got the eyes to see underneath the surface of what's going on in a 3D context. Now, there's a number of things. New Zealand has harpooka, and we have marlin, and we have packhorse crayfish. And I want to talk just a little bit about them to see how sustainable or how many there are, if you know of that. Yeah. And also, I'd like to talk about what goes into the water from the standpoint. When I was a kid, I used to go down fishing at Mount Maunganui Wharf. There's a little jetty in Pilot Bay just around at the base of the mount. And the little jetty jutted out into the water. The water was really, really clear. And you could see Mau Mau, you could see Parori, you could see Herring, there was Piper, there was Cockabillies. There were so many fish, and it was swarming with fish. Now you go down there today, and the water is not as clear, and there's hardly any fish whatsoever. And also around the rocks, all through the East Coast Bays on the North Shore, 50 years ago, or say 200 years ago, it would have been teeming with fish. But now, with cars going along the road, from battery acid to oil dripping on the road from cars and rubber and the chemicals in rubber, lots of this runoff ends up down on the beach, and consequently we don't have fish in the close-in areas of bays and rockeries around New Zealand. Can you add to this?
Some of that could well be because of increased sedimentation and pollution, and sedimentation of our inshore has been an issue ever since Pākehā particularly came to New Zealand, because we cut down the forests and there was a huge pulse of sediment went into our inshore waters. And that sediment is one of the factors why we have so little seagrass, which I talked about in relation to baby snapper earlier. But we also have huge changes in the fisheries environment, and we have, there's this phenomenon called shifting baselines. People only remember what it was like as they were kids. They don't remember, unless their grandparents told them, they don't remember what it was like before. And you mentioned Harpocket. This is quite a good example of this. Wade Doak and Roger Grace, who are divers from way back, right, early years of scuba diving, they used to see Harpocket in that quite regularly when they dived originally. And Wade said a few years ago that he hadn't seen them in diveable depth for 20 years. Quite a big Harpocket fishery, just both commercially and also recreationally. It's sort of retaked fish, and people talk about the offshore pinnacles where they go to get Harpocket and that, and they're a deep water fish. You need to bring them up from hundreds of metres, etc. Well, I think it was Chap Graham, he was one of the original fishery scientists from the time of the First World War, and he actually set up the Portobello Marine Station in Dunedin. In his book, Treasury of New Zealand Fishes, he talks about seeing Harpocket in Otago Harbour, literally seeing them from a boat, because they used to come right inshore. Maybe the reason that we only catch Harpocket from several hundred metres depth is because we've actually fished them down to the point that that's the only place where they survive, where they're away from fishermen, basically. There has been, I mean, I know Wade Doak put out on his discussion forum on his website this Harpocket issue, and there has been a few photographs of, you know, Harpocket seen at the nights and things like that by divers. But the point is, it's so rare, it's considered exceptional, and people grab photographs and talk about it. The reality is, years ago they were there just as normal part of being. They were talking just in terms of a few decades from when Wade and that were diving as young men and what the situation is now when they're in their 60s. That's a huge change, and that's happening probably with a lot of species. I had a property on Rakeno Island in the 1970s and early 80s, and I lived there for a while, and it used to be that you could put a sprat net out on Home Bay Beach and you'd catch sprats, but you'd also get a whole lot of piper. And that was being done in the 60s. There's a photo in Shirley Maddox's book, Islands of the Gulf, of Jack Jeffs pulling in a net full of piper. Well, when I was putting out nets in the late 70s, we got one or two piper. We thought we were doing really, really well. And that sort of change is something that a lot of people talk about, you know, around our coast. And whether that's been driven by overfishing or whether it's been driven by changes in the environment like sedimentation or pollution, the extra nutrients in the water, and nobody's really clear on, but it is recognised now that pollution is a significant factor. The Minister of Fisheries recently, over the last few years, has had a fish plan process running, which with their reorganisation has been almost knocked on the head. But what came out of that for some of those plans, like the Northwest Spinfish Plan, which is the whole west coast of the North Island? The number one priority, which all the stakeholders, be they commercial, recreational, environmental, customary fishers, saw, was dealing with the land-based effects on the marine environment and fisheries. And the senior Ministry of Fisheries manager involved with that process said that when they started that process, it had never occurred to them in the wildest flights of their imagination that that would be the number one priority that people would see. It's been important. They thought we'd be all haggling about the level of cost.